You are listening to 103.1 WVLP LP in Valparaiso, Indiana.
Piece by piece, only way to make a work of art. Every moment makes a contribution. Every little detail plays a part. Having just the vision's no solution. Everything depends on execution. Putting it together, that's what counts.
And welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM. This is our weekly program covering arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art in the Air. Our underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso Brower Museum and our landlord, Walt Breitinger. If you'd like to find out more about leasing space in our historic building, call Walt at 219-462-5821. That's 219-462-5821. And we'd like to thank them both for their generous support. Always thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP station manager for our show today, and always helping us to make things happen right here.
And hey, fabulous.
He's fabulous. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, or appear as an artist, please email us at artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. That's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. And I would love to hear from you about whatever you want to do. By the way, this program, along with all programs, are streaming live at wvlp.org. So if you have trouble getting us over the air, you can hear us right there. We're rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m. You can listen to our show archive, and I guess you call it podcast, at breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BREC.com/AOTA, and you can hear all of our show archives. The show today will be up probably around 5-6 o'clock today. Our shows are carried also on WIUN Red Hawk Radio at IU Northwest as a closed online radio station. Now we'd like to talk to you about our underwriting support. Community radio stations like this depend on not only listeners, but we look for people that support us, give your underwriting. So we want to convert you from being just a pure listener to becoming an underwriter. If you like a particular show or just like generally what WVLP is doing, you can become part of the family of supporters anytime. And you can find out more about that at wvlp.org/support. Esther and I especially would invite you to become an underwriter of this program, especially if you're interested in the art or arts. We have underwriter levels at all different things. We'll mention your program, business, or whatever is several times throughout the broadcast day, and especially if you're specifically on a program. So you can find out more, again, at wvlp.org/support. And like I always say, don't be just a WVLP listener. Become a supporter or underwriter. And don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. And you'll feel good about supporting WVLP in whatever amounts you can. Well, I guess we're about ready to start with the arts calendar. And we're going to start with Porter County. Valparaiso University Center for the Arts, Brower Museum. They will have a new exhibit coming, and it's opening May 17th through August 4th. It'll be Corey Hegelberg, which we'll have on in about 3 weeks, along with Greg Hertzlieb.
Yeah, he's been doing stuff all over town. It's been exciting.
It'll be great. And also, Rob Bent Lentling will be part of that same exhibit. So the two of them together. It's called No Beauty, New Acquisitions, Selections, and Things Like That. So you'll get to see that. They'll have a gallery talk on Wednesday, July 10th. We'll remind you more when we get closer to that. The Village at Pines, Kathy Loss Rathburn exhibit featuring there starts May 19th. It's called Regional Industrial Insights. And if you've not seen this work, I've seen it at South Shore when she exhibited it there. And actually, Kathy departed from her normal watercolor of scenics and things to looking at cities and industrial things. And so she takes a trip through that. That will be opening Sunday, May 19th. It'll be on exhibit for a month. Get to see the regional's industrial landscape. The Village Gallery is at Pines Village Circle in Valparaiso. You can find out more information online or on Facebook. Chesterton Art Center, their May exhibit, May You Have Flowers, and that will be running through this month. It's a wonderful exhibit. We saw that. Just all flowers of some kind and inspiration. By the way, the $1,000 Gloria Rector Memorial Scholarship went to Trinity Seebeck from the Chesterton High School. She'll be studying at the American Academy of Art next year upon graduation. She's going to specialize in fine arts and illustration.
Congratulations.
It's a great thing that they do there from the high school show. Mac Vandervine, Critique Night at Chesterton Art Center is always the first Wednesday of each month, so you get a chance to see that. that at 7:30. Dick Church will be offering beginning intermediate watercolor class that began or will begin May 31st. You can find out information there. And also there's a whole range of kids' classes. They have summer art camp coming up. Jennifer Martin does a wonderful job with preschool and young school ages. Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, they have a great thing. And they also starting up their Monday night ceramics. So you can contact Chesterton Arts Center either on Facebook, online, or give them a call, 926-4711. That's 926-4711 or ChestertonArt.com. Art Barn. Well, they're doing their 26th annual juried exhibition, and it's opening May 18th through June 27th. It's going to have painting, drawing, all those types of things in there. No photography, though. open mic performances also.
Soon.
We'll convince them of that. Yeah, that photography does count as fine art. Open mic performances also are continuing there on May 24th. So it's a fun night there, 7 to 10 p.m. Artsy Fine Arts and Antiques in Chesterton. It's at 206 South Calumet. Hola, back by popular demand as they paint your sugar skull class. So you can do that. That's on Friday, May 17th. So if you're listening to us live, that's today. So you don't miss out at 6 o'clock. It's only 12 people allowed, 16 years and older. They'll be doing that. Also on Saturday, May 18th, they'll be doing an acrylic pour where they just pour creatively paints and everything. Mm-hmm. Dig the Dunes, like to remind you, along the South Shore, have teamed up to create Indiana Dunes postcards. 24 people will be selected, bundling to 3 packs of 8. The deadline to submit is May 31st, so you can submit your information to digthedunes.com, and then they're looking for pictures of the dunes of all different kinds of things. You can submit up to 3 photos and do that, so do that right now. Duneland Photography Club, they're continuing at Red Cup Cafe with Too Big, Too Small, and that's running through this month at Red Cup Cafe in downtown Chesterton on Broadway Street. The Ellen Firm Gallery continues with egg tempera artist Kai Konstantinov. She already had her reception, so you can see her work all throughout there.
Go see her work.
I did see it, and it was a wonderful exhibit. So that's really about all we have in Porter County. Esther's going to tell you what we have going on LaPorte County.
Busy LaPorte County. The Thaddeus C. Gallery, located in downtown LaPorte at 822 Lincoln Way. Their current exhibit is Rush, and that has an exclamation point at the end. Gallery hours are 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., Tuesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. Their phone number, 219-326-8626, or find them on the web at thaddeusc.com or on Facebook, Thaddeus C. Gallery. Lubesnik Center for the Arts, Nature versus Everything. That exhibit runs through June 8th, and it features 9 contemporary artists in a new, environmentally-minded exhibit that explores the perilous battle between humanity and the natural world. There's also a large-scale installation in the Susan Block Gallery on the second floor. It starts with an animated video of a charcoal-drawn landscape with its inhabitants and extends into 3 colorful dimensions so that the viewer becomes part of the art. Southern Shore Artists Association. It's usually SFC that I have problems with, not Southern Shore Art Association. The gallery is located at 724 Franklin Street. Their new exhibit is an all-painting show titled Patterns, Color, and Light, and it runs to June 2nd. Oil painting, acrylic, watercolor, and pastels with color, light, or pattern as the major element. That's the highlight for this exhibit. The gallery is open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 12 to 5 p.m. Visit their website, SouthernShoreArtAssociation.com, or Facebook page, Southern Shore Art Association. So now the next one I'll get on the first try. SFC Gallery.
Which is actually Sharp Eye, right? Sharp Eye Framing Company.
It is. Is it at 607, which would be easier to say, 607 Franklin Street, and is showing the work of photographer Albert George. He works exclusively with black and white film, usually medium and large format, and creates prints by hand in the darkroom using traditional printing techniques. This exhibit runs through the end of the month, and their website is sfcgallery.com and on Facebook, SFC Gallery. Blink Contemporary Art at 1709 Franklin Street has the exhibit Artists Do Artists. Have you ever wondered who inspires or influences artists? They have a large list of artists who will be exhibiting, and it's really a great show. Greg Hertzlieb, the former host, is one of the artists. He has 2 brilliant pieces in this show, and the show will run through July 28th. Blink can be reached at 773-206-0426 or on the web at blinkcontemporaryart.com or Facebook Blink Contemporary Art. Rising Phoenix Gallery at 2803 South Franklin Street will have the work of Dorothy Graydon. The exhibit is called Timeless Mysteries and runs through June 2nd. Beautiful, beautiful.
It was a wonderful exhibit. Yes.
Gallery hours, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, 10 to 4. Saturday, 10 to 6 p.m. and Sunday, 11 to 4 p.m. Their phone number is 480-216-2583. Their Facebook page is the Rising Phoenix Gallery. They also offer really interesting classes, too. So,
I mean, last week's guest used to live in that little building there, too. That was very interesting.
I know. It was very interesting. Nest, located at 803 Franklin Street, the new exhibit in the gallery is the photography of Joel Brussel, titled The Somewhere Else of Being Here. The images were all taken within 4 to 5 blocks of where he lives, but they have the appearance of being otherworldly. All the photos were taken with an iPhone 7, and we have some really big enlargements on those little iPhone 7 images. Ongoing in the Nest, we have oil painting with Michelle Weiser on Mondays, starting at 6 p.m. Sign up ahead, please. Drum circle every second Friday of the month at 6:30. Don Wenig of Dancing Feet Yoga is the facilitator. May 18th and every third Saturday of the month at 7 p.m. we have the Every Kind of Talent Show with Captain Ambivalent. He's the master of ceremonies. It's vaudeville meets show and tell meets open mic. And we're always looking for magicians, dancers, opera singers, filmmakers, actors, comedians, poets, storytellers, solo or group musicians, visual artists, demos. Sign up ahead to guarantee a spot, but you can also sign up the night of the performance, pending, you know, time and space. The best way to reach us is email thenestmichigancity at gmail.com or Facebook message us. We also have tickets for the Swale Music Fest, which happens Saturday, June 8th at Westcott Park from 1 to 10 p.m. So that's it for LaPorte County
is really hopping there. So,
yeah.
Well, now we're going to move on to Lake County, 119th Street Artists at the Cornerstone Gallery. They'll be doing their second to last exhibit coming up. It's called Concepts and Compositions. You can find out information for a submission at 119thstreetartists.org or email them. They're also on Facebook. You can see the artist concept. They'll be running later in June and summer, and then their final exhibit will be September, October with Sarah Pete Convery, and then, of course, they're out of there, and hopefully they can partner with something else. Also in Whiting, Studio 659, they'll be doing Fandom, which opens on May 19th. They have superheroes, cult classics, underappreciated. You can find out information at studio659.org. It's on 119th Street in Whiting. They're open on Thursday, Friday, from 12 to 7, Saturday from 10 to 2. So you can find out information about them and what they're doing in Whiting. South Shore Arts, well, they're still taking registration for summer classes, and we won't list all the classes, but you can go online or go to Facebook and find out what's going on. If you have something for your kids to do in the summer or even for adults, they have great things. Plus, they're taking reservation for the 26th annual Bozarth Ball with the theme Rock It Man, One Small Step for You, One Giant Leap for the Arts. So the Bozarth Ball occurs on June 7th. It begins at 6 p.m. It's a great event, a great supporter for that. Bachman Gallery, the 45th Tri-County Show, will be winding up this weekend. So you can see that. The award ceremony already passed, so you can get one last chance to see the Junior Senior High School exhibit there, which has been there for just a little over a month. The Atrium Gallery, Celebrating Birds, features the work of Kimberly Beck, Christina Kanowski, and Sue Gombas, and they'll be running through June 16th. They will have their artist reception coming up on Sunday, May 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. That's at the Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. Toll Theater in Hammond will be featuring the art of Wendy Wilkin, Guardia La Mia Artes. I'm not great with my Spanish, but I hope I didn't murder that too much. They'll be running May 3rd through June 20th, so you can visit that there during the theater pre-show hours. Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, they'll be continuing with Evidence of Time Spent by Camara Sartiero. That will open May 3rd, and runs through May 26th, and you can see that at the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts on Lake Street in Gary. You can find out information about them at millerbeacharts.org or on their Facebook page. South Lake Cooperative, known commonly as SLAC, continues with their geometry exhibit at the Wild Rose Brewery in Griffith, and their new exhibit is called Texture, and that's at the Sip Coffee House in Crown Point. They are only on Facebook. You can find them at South Lake Artist Cooperative. We always call them SLAC because their artists like to call themselves Slackers. Ileana Artists, they will be having an exhibit with information coming up. Watch the Ileana Artists website. It'll be at the Chesterton Art Center, so you can find out information about that. The exhibit's coming up in September, so they'll have information coming out soon about their wonderful art coming up in there. And tonight is the final concert, or I believe it's the final concert, of Northwest Indiana Symphony, One Giant Step. It's on Friday, May 17th, so if you're listening live, that's tonight. With the Symphony Chorus, special guest will be former NASA astronaut Colonel Jerry Ross from Crown Point. And they'll be celebrating the historic moon landing in 1969. They'll have two of Copeland's most popular pieces, Fanfare for the Common Man, Appalachian Spring, and themes from Star Wars, Star Trek, the 2001 Space Odyssey scene. If you have a say, also Sprach zu Raster from that, people don't know what that is. And also selections from Holtz the Planets. I remember playing Holtz the Planets when I was in band many, many years ago. It was a long time. You find information, that's going to be at Monbeck Auditorium at Highland High School, one of my old stamping grounds from many years ago. And that's all we have going on in Lake County. I'd like to remind you once again to support. We are Art on the Air, WVLP, and you can go to WVLP.org/support and support us in whatever level you can. It's ever so important. We are also being carried on Red Hawk Radio at IUN Northwest.
Yay.
And we hope to expand that. And by the way, if you are interested in carrying our show, we'd be interested in having it be carried. So you can contact us, and we'll be happy to tell you that information. Well, we are excited about our guest today. We know quite a bit about her because we both sat on the grant committee for her grant application. So we know just about everything about her and everything. Deborah Silvert, she's acclaimed for her sunny and golden tone on the flute. She's performed throughout the United States, Europe, Asia, delighting audiences, but she's also part of a duo. Unfortunately, the other part of the duo is down in, I think, South Carolina, so we couldn't have him today, but that means we'll have to have them both back at some point.
At some point.
And we're going to listen to some of the samples of their music, but we'd like to welcome to the show, Deborah.
Thank you so much, Larry, Esther. Good to be with you.
Well, we'd like to start off with a little bit about you, where you're from originally, and how you got from here to there.
So I grew up in one of the suburbs of Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
And how did I get from here to there? I mean, the short of it was I did not come from a musical family. I came from a very dysfunctional family and sort of had the soul of an artist, I suppose, because I was very reactive, a crazy teenager running away long distance when I was 15 years old.
Wow. So you were a wild woman.
I was wild. I was crazy. And so I ended up in a foster home. And it was the foster family that was musical, and they offered private lessons for me on the flute. I'd always wanted to play the harp.
I know. Did you pick the flute, or
well,
was it just?
Yeah, I did pick the flute. I did pick the flute. The first choice would have been harp, but that was off the table.
It was my first choice too, but yeah.
I mean, they're just so expensive. It was just
And it's like having an elderly parent. Hard to get in the car. Hard to get out,
you're
and it's out of tune in 10 minutes, right? You know
exactly. But I fell in love with the sound of the flute, and I just really got involved with the idea of the breath, you know, the breath on the flute. And so
reedless woodwind we have.
Yeah, the reedless woodwind, but it's an air reed. It's
right.
That, you know, it's that column of air that's doing the vibrating and creating the sound. So I like to think of it as being even kind of closer spiritually to God than even the voice, because you know, the voice still involves the vocal cords.
Exactly.
This is just pure air, pure breath. You know, so that's kind of a neat idea. That really, I mean, that inspires me.
So you're in a foster home and you're learning the flute.
Learned the flute, and I decided, like, right early on that I wanted to be, you know, a concert artist. But that was, you know, that was about as realistic as me going to the moon the next week.
Right.
Because I had no background. But I was, you know, not to
determined.
Be daunted. Yeah, I was pretty determined. And I auditioned for State University of New York at Buffalo, which was quite a good music school and really known for contemporary classical music, and auditioned there several times. And, I was told, really, just give it up.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
There's so many.
So
there are so many concert musicians, though, who have heard that. So, and there's the determination that
Well,
comes
I think
in.
you you know, technique, it's an interesting thing because I really didn't start the lessons until I was 16. Mm-hmm. And one of my teachers was Jeffrey Gilbert, who is, he was actually James Galway's teacher and a very, very famous flutist, you know, in London, and a very famous pedagogue. And he used to make a comment that he had all the technique, all the actual mechanical technique that he would ever need throughout his whole life by the age of 16. Well, I was just starting at the age of 16. So it took some years for me to get that up. But, yeah.
What other instruments was played? You said the family was musical.
Piano and violin. Yeah, my foster sister played the violin and my foster mother played the piano. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not really on a real serious level. Like when I took it up, I was already I already started to practice 5 hours a day. But the thing was, I was moved from one school system to another, and it was senior year. Well, that was unplanned too. I was kind of fast tracked, and I didn't have any friends. I didn't have anything else to do. and I had this mission, you know, this passion all of a sudden. And so what better to do with it than practice? And that's what I did.
So rehearse, rehearse, rehearse. That's how you get to Carnegie Hall, right?
Yeah. Right, basically.
Mm-hmm. So you went to college, and eventually you got in.
Yeah, eventually got in. And it was so funny because at first I was accepted in a BA program, okay, which is a liberal arts degree in music, with kind of raised eyebrows, like, okay, we're going to take you sort of on a probationary status. But then I continued to, you know, improve. And then I got into the Bachelor of Music Education program, which was, another notch up in, you know, sure, performance ability. And then I couldn't see myself as a band director.
Right.
So then I wanted to be in the BM program, which is a performance program. So I got into that. And then once I got into the BM program, I sat back and thought, well, now how am I going to make a living at this? And so I went into social work because, you know, that's a big living.
Yeah, there you go.
So my degree is actually in social work.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I have, I'm actually just one class short of my BM in performance.
Okay. One well, you class. Need to finish that, I guess. Yeah. I mean, even though you're out there performing and everything professionally, but.
Yeah, I don't know. That's not on the table right now.
I guess it's not necessary. A lot of times in life, you find that the practical education you get, and I know I found that with my doctorate, mm-hmm, is I really learned that much from my doctorate. It's a matter of relating what I had learned and putting it into something that could be evaluated.
Right. Well, the class is a one year long class in music history with a lab. And when I did it, the fact was that the professor could have let me do it. It was conflicting with my senior social work practicum, which took me out of town 2 days a week, and that was the 2 days that the lab took place on. So I could have done that lab. It was a listening lab. I could have done it, you know, in the evenings had he permitted, but he didn't. And I could do it to get it, but I don't see what.
Yeah, what's the point at this point?
What's the point at this point, right?
Yeah, it's nice to have the credential, but at this point it's like, well, I already doing that. So so then you finished college with social work. So you did social work.
I did do social work. I was a social worker at Tradewinds Rehabilitation Center in around 1980-83.
So you must have known Greg Ladd.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I worked with him years and years. My wife also worked there. Carolyn Hilligans.
Yes, that's familiar.
Well, that's my wife,
Carolyn. Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, so definitely, and over there on 7th Avenue, I was a social worker.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was part of the founding group for Main Square Players in Highland.
Wow, that's crazy. Small world.
Small world, yes.
Very small world.
So you were there for how long?
I think 4 years.
Okay.
And I had wanted to get into mental health, and so I took a job at Porter Stark.
Okay.
Then, and actually it brought me back to Valparaiso, because and then I married my husband in 86.
Okay.
And we were planning to start a family right away or soon. So how that happened was that I said, boy, you know, this is the last time. I was very, by that time I had come up into like young artist level.
Right.
I was doing a lot of these national young artist competitions and things. And I was finding that I was choking in competition. Mm-hmm. I want to play more. Do more performances because that'll help with choking and competition. And then I thought, well, you know, how good could I really get if I did nothing but practice? You know, if I had nothing else on the table. Now that I have all the, you know,
the technique,
the technique and the groundwork is laid, the foundation is solid, what could I really do? So he said, you know, we don't really need your income, you know, and this will be the last chance before you get pregnant. So, yeah, do it. So what was supposed to be 1 year of, you know, me devoted to the flute ended up being 4 years of infertility.
Oh my gosh!
Five, yeah. So I just kept with that because infertility is its own, you know, stressor, and I threw myself even more into the flute, and then we started adopting our kids.
And you have four of them.
We have four of them by adoption. Yes, we do. But in the interim there, Paul Bowman came home from Manhattan to Chesterton, where he grew up, because he was trying to make a career in New York, freelancing and so on. And he'd won an international competition, first prize, and was doing very well as a guitarist in New York in that whole scene. But it's very, very expensive to live in New York. Yeah. And it was, you know, it's like he just couldn't get ahead. So he came back to Chesterton, started to make inquiries because he had had a lot of experience with flute and guitar with that literature. And so he very much wanted to form a duo. And he heard about me, called me up and said, "You want to do this? I have a personal letter of recommendation from Lucas Foss." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, okay, I guess that's good enough. I'll accept that." So we got together, and it was kind of pretty much an instant rapport.
It's kismet.
It really was kismet. It really was. I'd like to think meant to be. He was right here in Chesterton.
Wow.
And so we formed Duo Sequenza. That was 1988.
Wow. So, and unfortunately, Paul can't be here today. He's in South Carolina.
He's in South Carolina. So what happened, we were together until 93 when he married an opera singer.
Okay.
And his wife got a job in an opera house in Europe. So he, of course, followed her to Europe. And he continued his concertizing over there. And I, by that time, had two kids. And there wasn't really anyone else that I was inspired to play with. Because one of the things when you're in chamber music is I think you really become inspired by your co-players.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It's just a whole transcendent
very symbiotic,
kind of thing. It's
yeah.
very intimate. Yeah.
Very, very intimate. And I just couldn't, I didn't feel... so inspired. I was on the faculty at VU at the time, so I was doing, you know, some chamber work with other faculty members there, but nothing where I wanted to make a, you know, a real entity of a,
right.
of a chamber ensemble that would be sort of permanent and touring. And the kids, my kids were little anyway. It really wasn't in the cards. I had these two little kids. So we had 21 years that Paul and I did not communicate even.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because he was,
goes
I was
fast,
involved.
Though, doesn't it?
Crazy fast, crazy mm-hmm. fast. And I was involved with my kids, and I was at the university, I think, about 5 years. I stopped, left the faculty there in 99 because I moved to Chicago for a while. And then... in 2014, in the fall, I'd gone to our National Flute Association convention, and that was kind of a weird thing because I'm walking around the convention. I didn't reach out to any of my former colleagues, you know, before going because it felt kind of weird. You know, I dropped out for 21 years. And when I got there, you know, people are like, "Whoa, Deb, you're back." Like, "Wow, where have you been?" Like, "Wow." You know, so it was kind of very... affirming. And you know, sitting in, you know, what we do for 4 days of flute convention is we listen. I mean, there's hundreds of recitals and we're listening to each other. It's, you know, invitational to perform. And so I'm listening and I'm thinking, what, I want to play. This is crazy. Why am I not playing? My kids are grown now. My youngest was 21 at that time, or no, I guess she was 18 at that time. And so I came home from the convention and I said to my husband, "Honey, I want to play again."
Yeah.
And he says, "Well,
it's
you should
such
play.
A beloved
you
instrument." Play.
And I said, "Well, I don't have anyone to play with." And he says, "Well, call Paul." And I said, "Well, I haven't been in touch with Paul for 21 years. He says, "So, you know, look him up." So I Googled him and I sent him an email. And 40 minutes later, he emailed back and said, "Yeah, let's do this. Let's put
fantastic.
It back together." Yeah, it was really neat.
And I found out interesting in your interim period there that you homeschooled all four of your kids.
I did. To
wow.
varying degrees. To varying
that's a
degrees.
Challenge in and of itself.
Are they musical?
No.
Did they pick it up? Did they, you know?
No, I mean, they all had the impulse and they all had a little bit of, you know, a little bit of music, but none of them really pursued it. Probably, they're all very different children having, you know, from different genetic backgrounds, you know. So, but I do have my daughter, my second child, who's my oldest daughter, has very severe challenges, disabilities, but she has incredible musical gifts such that, you know, like I'm in awe of her, mm-hmm. and she's really sort of an asset to me sometimes. She's got absolute perfect pitch. She has absolute retention of things. She's really remarkably gifted, mm-hmm. and very disabled in terms of output. So, yeah, that's hard. But, yeah, none of the kids really went into it.
I want to backtrack for a minute. Mm-hmm. When you said you took that initial year off just to practice, did you play out then too? I'm very interested in the choking, because with your background, was it an anxiety thing? Or
it was that anxiety. It was never getting over that idea that you're not good enough, you know? And one thing that helped that tremendously was in that first year, I went ahead and I submitted, at the time, the Indian Arts Commission had they called it a presenter touring program.
Right.
I don't know if you remember that, but it was sort of a roster of juried approved artists that were grant eligible. And this roster went out to the presenters throughout the state, and then the presenter was able to apply for a grant to help them pay the artist's fee to get, you know, to stimulate touring throughout the state. So I had submitted an application for that, and I was accepted. And that was like, wow. So I'm actually, you know, a professional flutist now. I can tour. So I was doing that. I was promoting and going out on that touring roster, Flute Alone and Flute and Piano.
Yeah. And did that feel good?
Yeah.
You're listening to Deborah Sievert on our program Art on the Air, carried here on WVLP 103.1 FM and also on WIUN, Indiana University's Red Hawk Radio. So anyway, you were saying, so you were a part of that roster, and mm-hmm. did regular performances or just like on call?
Well, I did a mailing. This is how it used to be back in the day.
Before
email, we would do a bulk mailing. And when I say we, you know, I did it as a soloist, and then Paul and I did it later as a duo. We would just do a bulk mailing to the presenters to sort of get them interested, ask them if they wanted to receive a demo tape. Remember cassettes?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So we would
I ran a recording studio that did demos from the 70s
and
80s.
There you go. So we would send out our demo cassette, and then they would, you know, either hire me or, you know, and later do a sequenza or not. And then we would try to block book from there. Once we had a kind of an anchor booking, then we would look for, you know, other presenters within a certain radius, a certain drive.
And so what type of venues? Because I'm really interested to know, because I love what you're doing in the unusual venues, you know, picking non-typical concert venues music. Was that like maybe the start of it?
No, not at all. Back then there actually were a fine arts series and chamber music series that existed. A lot of them were taking places in churches, because churches have generally nice acoustics for that. And acoustics are a big part of our whole sound. So there were like fine arts councils in various towns, chamber music series, and that's where we went out to. We were also part of Columbia Artists Management International. They used to do you remember Community Concerts, Inc.?
Yeah.
Okay, so when we were first concertizing as Duo Sequenza 88 to 93, there were 3,000 community concert associations throughout the country. So we got a number of concerts through them, and those audiences were in the hundreds, sometimes even 1,000.
Yeah, that was going to be, I was wondering what the audience was.
Tremendous audience, and they were, you know, they were subscription series. Well, somehow in the intervening years, those, you know, there wasn't enough done to really develop audiences, which is what we're trying to do now, and those audiences just dwindled. You know, they were older than us at the time.
You're right.
You know, and they aged, and many of them died. Yeah, they aged out, they died, and there weren't new people coming up to replace them. So that is actually a thing of the past. There are no more Community Concerts, Inc. There are several hundred surviving organizations. Like, we even have one here, the Valparaiso Concert Association, I think is one.
And also you have what used to be Hammond Community Concerts, went to Munster Community Concerts, now Lakeshore Community Concerts.
Right.
Because I brought them when I was the Auditorium and Theater Director at Munster.
Right, and there's Portage Township Live Entertainment Association. Right. So those are, and it's amazing that many held on here in our local area. But they generally are not booking classical music. It's a very, very hard sell.
It's a tough sell.
It's a very hard sell. And that's, you know, that's really our concern at this point coming back. You know, we can tour, and we will tour and are touring. But, you know, like in the South Shore region, we would love to see, you know, we've seen LaPorte Symphony, do more and more pops. Northwest Indiana Symphony's doing more and more pops. You know, you have to do pops. You have to do non-classical to get audiences. Well, I don't know if that's the right way to go, because it seems like we're so overexposed to the vernacular, to the pops. Right. We need, if we're going to develop classical music listeners, we've got to give them classical music. How else are they going to know that they like it? So our position is that people don't know what they don't know.
Right.
So that's where we're now, Esther, taking it out.
Because we've done two concerts. We did one concert, three flutes, and one four flutes and a piano. And boy, it was like fabulous.
Yeah.
People
love it when they hear it. Right. But the other problem, I think, is that, you know, I think when you look at the visual arts, like you just did the calendar, overwhelmingly visual arts. Mm-hmm. Why? You know, why can the visual arts be successful and the performing arts struggle so much? And I think it's that.
I think the visual artists are struggling.
Everybody is, because you're right. Attendance is down.
Yeah.
But I think one of the particular things with music and performance art is that it's in time.
Right.
In time and space. You've got to be there in that audience at that time.
It's so rich. It's such a rich experience.
Well, and we've talked about this before on the show. There are so many alternatives to compete with, and this is true of live theater, live concerts. Mm-hmm. It's so much easier to just sit at home, watch your Netflix, Hulu, things like that, and just not go out. I mean, I think, so you're competing against a whole new medium. Even appointment television no longer exists, because you can now, since the VCR, but now it's much more sophisticated. So you're right. You're competing against a whole thing. You know, and back to what you were saying about Pops concerts, or that when the Star Plaza was there and the Symphony would do it, their Pops concerts were almost like 3,000 people showing up.
Because it's familiar.
Right, but they would do their classical concerts, and they were lucky to get maybe 700 or so or less. In fact, I remember when I was at my auditorium, I said, you know, you might be it's cheaper to bring it to like a school auditorium. I know there was a certain status going to Star Plaza, but I know it cost a base price of just $5,000 plus stuff. So usually a concert at there costs $10,000 to put in there.
Yes.
Could put that same concert in my space for about $2,000.
Yes.
I said, so, and you know, I had a 1,000-seat theater at Munster, a 1,400-seat at Monbeck and Highland. So I said, if nothing else, if you don't do it in one venue, I said, you could say, we're bringing the classics into your community. Go to Munster, Crown Point, Valpo. But they never quite bought that until after the Star Plaza died.
You make a very important point. The production cost is huge
when we're talking
about this. And so one of the things we tried to do in Project Listen Up was to eliminate that overhead, you know, take it into a potential venue, a space, and really let that space, whoever is the proprietor of that space, let them promote it to their people. We don't have enough people. We don't have enough fans and followers in classical music today, much less chamber music. People still don't know what chamber music is. And that really took down a lot of the overhead. It got the music delivered. It got it out there. But it also is why recording today, this recording that we did, it's so important. Because, you know, years ago, to do an album, it was kind of a vanity project. You did an album, it wasn't really...
Sure.
There wasn't a mission. You did an album, but mainly it was about being a concert artist, and that means giving concerts. Today, the venues are just not there. The opportunities are not there. And there's such an emphasis on entrepreneurship now. Even, you know, the major conservatories, New England Conservatory, Juilliard, Eastman, they require arts entrepreneurship classes, arts administration classes, even for their performance majors, which is amazing. But that's what it has to be.
It does. It really does.
You have to
understand all of it.
So today, recording, we're thinking we're going to continue recording, because that's maybe the way that you get the listeners to come out. You know, if they can access it, you know, when they want to, where they want to, and they love it, now maybe they'll be inspired to come out.
Well, and then now we need to have it, though, available.
Exactly.
You know,
well,
which is
that.
Well, you posted a Facebook comment earlier today before the show, and I saw that about streaming versus buying the actual hard collar CD. And we talked a little bit about that for the show. So you said, what, you need a million streams?
We will need 1 million streams, $7,000.
And yet, what your CD would cost, like what retail would be?
I think it's retailing. Oh, I think it's $13.99 on Amazon.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
So
sure.
You would get much more percentage wise out of that,
right?
Per piece.
Right. Right. Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's like when you're working with a label and a
sure.
distribution company. I haven't yet seen how that all plays out. I mean, I know what our agreement is with the record company, but there's also royalties that have to be paid to
right.
all the composers. Nothing we do is public domain. I shouldn't say nothing. We do what I sarcastically refer to as music by dead white men.
Do you compose as well? Do
no,
you
not
compose?
At all. Not at all. That's a great question, though, Esther. I'd like to talk about that a bit, because I think like what we do as artists, Paul and I are both very much listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the compositions are ink on paper. They are not music. So we get these from composers, and we look at them, and we start to, you know, read through them. And, you know, it's not always apparent where the music is there. You know, it's really hard to get it off the page
mm-hmm.
and get it, you know, get it into the air, into
sure.
the universe. So, you know, there's a lot of learning. There's a lot of process there. And sort of internalizing, like, what is it that, and it's not very intellectual. I mean, it can be very intellectual as well, but it's not only intellectual, I should say. So you kind of have to form this communication bond over time and space with this composer. You know, when you do music by living composers, you can call them up,
right.
which is nice. And we do have a relationship with a lot of our composers. But it's to me, it's like the project is really... the idea, the process is listening and then turning that outward and communicating. You know, music is a universal language.
It is.
Well, speaking of music, we should actually listen to what Duo Sequenza sounds like. And we have fortunate to have it's from, your Yes, It's a Thing CD. And we're going to hear which cut?
We're going to hear the Lake Michigan cut. This is a track from the South Shore Suite, which was composed for Indiana's Bicentennial in 2016. By Jorge Muñez, who is the chairman of the music department at IUSB. And this was a work that we commissioned about our region because, you know, we're trying to engage our region in classical music.
So we're hearing Duo Sequenza with Deborah Silvert and Paul Bowman from their CD, which you can get on Amazon.com. Yes, it's a thing.
All right.
Thank you.
And that was Duo Sequenza. Yes, it's a thing. That's part of the South Shore Suite. And that was specifically the cut Lake Michigan. So what a wonderful piece that is. You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, also heard on WIUN, Red Hawk Radio. So, and how long has this CD been out?
So the CD was released on April 26th.
So this is really brand new.
It's brand new, yeah.
I remember I wanted to get you on for your CD release party, which was earlier this month, but we already had guests booked up.
Right, right. It's brand new. We're still getting reviews, you know, notices of reviews and airplay. Of course, airplay, sometimes that's months and months on down the road after release because, you know, there's a big pile waiting. But, yeah, we've had really good critical reviews, so very happy about that. Two of them from Fanfare Magazine, two different critics, which is terrific.
Excellent. And where can they get the CD? I know you said Amazon.
I think Barnes & Noble, our local store, was going to carry it. I haven't had time to follow through with them to see whether they did buy it. And it's distributed by Naxos International. So it's whatever retailers order it in. But it is up on Amazon. It's up on Archive Music. You can stream it from Spotify, Apple Music, iTunes.
All the usual
all
subjects.
Those platforms. All the usual suspects, right? Yeah, it's out there.
And do you want to put anything into local venues? Like, oh, I don't know, like Michigan
yes,
City, the Nest?
I do want to take it out. I intend to do that. I want to take it up to the gift shop for the Indiana Beach Tourism up
right.
north
mm-hmm.
because I think that's important, and have it at our local, on Lincoln Way, our local boutiques and so on. Take it over to the South Shore.
And then the South Shore Art Gallery
and Michigan City. And, yeah, get it out over there. Yeah, I do. But I haven't had time to do that yet.
We do carry CDs with artists who have performed in the gallery and some who haven't that we've met along the way.
So what other projects? I know you have several other projects. I know we know about Project Listen Up, but you have other projects coming up for your 2019 season. You've already been busy this season, but what else do you have coming up for Duo Sequenza?
We are actually talking about the next recordings.
Okay.
Kind of staying with this, yes, it's a thing theme. You know, we want to do a, yes, it's a Latin thing.
Okay.
Yes, it's a fragile thing or a breakable thing, which would be work for the crystal flute.
I love the way you think about marketing what you're doing. It's really brilliant.
Oh, thanks. I hope.
No.
It's tough. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is tough. Marketing is everything. And even to do another, yes, it's even more of a thing because these pieces that we recorded are all world premieres. Mm-hmm. They've never been recorded before, even though the oldest piece on there is 1989.
Wow.
Which is, you know, pretty old for never having been recorded. But it's expensive and, you know, it's
where do you record?
We recorded this up at WFMT in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Jesse McWaters was the engineer, who's just wonderful, wonderful producer and engineer. He's a classical musician himself, so it really it
translates.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, WFMT is a place to view it, right?
Yeah, and then it's FMT has a lovely live performance studio.
Right.
You know, acoustically, it's just magnificent.
I remember back in the 70s and 80s, the Midnight Special that they used to do with Norm Pellegrini.
And
they did a little off the, not so much classical, but a little bit off the beam stuff. But
That was a great show.
Oh, I love that.
So, you know, I'm always a fan of If It's Not Broke, Don't Fix It. So we really loved, you know, working up there, working with Jesse, and that's the plan going forward. This summer we are going to be doing a summer composition intensive, which is a two-week composer workshop. It'll be at St. Mary's College in South Bend. It's
Facilitating or are you participating?
No, we are the guest artists. So the composers are there for 2 weeks. The faculty, the composition faculty is Zay Munn, who she is actually on faculty there. Joshua Marquez, Laura Schwendinger, and James Aiken are the composition faculty. And then we're the guest artists. We'll be there two of the days. The first day will be demonstrating and lecturing on the intricacies of writing for flute and classical guitar duo. And then the second day that we're there, we'll be actually performing some of what the composers have.
Wow, tailor-made for you.
Yeah,
really?
Well, yeah. So that's coming up in July. And in August, I'll be at the National Flute Association
And if you see Wouter Kellerman, you need to say hi from me.
Last Grammys,
he invited, he says, oh, you need to come out to the party in Los Angeles. And I haven't been to the Grammys physically for quite a few years, but he said, oh, yeah, he's a standing invitation.
I'll definitely tell him.
It'll be really,
you know, like any business, there's a lot of networking.
It is. It's kind of funny how these people, I've never met him face-to-face, but I was like, how you connect with people like that.
Yeah.
I have a weird question about sequins. Actually, so when you get dressed up, because I looked at a lot of your images and you're in very beautiful, sequiny, lovely gowns. Like when you do, because it looks great on stage, of course. But do you feel different when you do that? Like when you go to the Moose Lodge, are you wearing your sequins? Are you?
Or
the coffee houses. And does it change? Is there an attitude change?
It does change. I don't know so much anymore if certainly for a formal concert, you know, in an actual hall where it's kind of maximum, like Paul's in a tux and I'm in like a gown. You definitely feel that. In touring, you know, here's the secret about sequins in touring. They pack great.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can about ball them up in a suitcase and then you can put them on and there's no wrinkles because they're sequins.
Except artists sometimes find them really hot because I would design costuming for performers.
I'm hot anyway and I have to just kind of embrace that. I tend to sweat a lot on stage, and I also wear wigs because I'm a married Orthodox Jewish woman. That's a thing with us, and wigs are hot, you know. So I'm just used to being overheated when I play, so it doesn't bother me so much what I wear. But I definitely do try to keep in mind what the venue is and who the audience is. Like, you don't want to make the whole idea is engaging with the audience and connecting with the audience.
Sure.
I don't want to dress in a way that's going to be off-putting to the audience. I don't want them to come in and feel like they're underdressed if I'm all blinged out. So, yeah, you do have to kind of think about that. But I get what you're saying. It's like just... It's what we do. You know, so much of it, you know, you've seen that meme of the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
You know, so it's that little iceberg thing that you've got all this stuff that's under the surface, all this work and preparation and you know.
Because there's something about going into that space, like you put on that dress and you're like, okay, I'm here. I know where I am.
Yeah, for me it's less of the dress than it is the, you know, walking out in front of the audience.
Sure.
You know, seeing the audience. You know, seeing the listeners, that to me is what makes the transition.
The click.
Yeah. And, you know, in audiences anymore, even in concerts, are less dressed up.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, they're used to dress up to go to a classical concert, the ballet or something like that.
Yeah, well, nobody dresses up
I dress
to
up to
anymore.
Go to the Meyer because that's my, you know, like, because there aren't very many dress up,
right,
like, kind of things anymore.
But, yeah, so. That's, I mean, I in my personal thing, if I'm going to a concert, I usually dress up to some level, and if I'm going to a real concert, yeah. But I think that is passé. I've seen the Lakeshore concerts thing. People came fairly casually to those
people
things.
People have asked me what they should wear, you know. Yeah. I'm coming to your concert. What should I wear? I tell people, wear anything you want.
Sure.
Because
yeah,
in our...
completely.
One of the, you know, like the culture of our concert hall, even the most formal concerts that we do, we want to have... a real connection with the audience. We want to make everybody feel comfortable. Our audiences are too small these days for chamber music and for classical music. You cannot alienate anyone.
Yeah.
Everybody has to feel like they belong there. So when we have applause in between movements, you know.
Right.
That used to be a horrible thing. But now we just embrace it, welcome it, you know. Thank you.
Yeah, I always.
It's all okay.
So we're going to wrap it up. Any final quick thoughts here? We're going to play out, by the way, with Dillinger, which is also from the South Shore Suite.
It wasn't Dillinger. No. We decided
number
on... number four was Rigadoon by
Dillinger. Oh, that's okay. And Rigadoon. That's from a different one. So that's what we're going to do.
That's one that's queued up. So,
yeah.
So any final thoughts here?
Yeah, I just want to just put a plug out there. We're going to be doing a collaboration, we hope, with Miller Beach Arts and Creative.
Okay.
One of the composers that's featured on the disc is Jerry Owen, and he's a native of Miller Beach, grew up in Miller, and we want to do a whole Jerry Owen concert with Miller Beach Arts and Creative in November.
Wow.
So that's coming up.
Well, you've been listening to Deborah Silvert from Dua Sequenza and Art on the Air, and I'd like to thank her today. Art on the Air is heard every Friday.
Hour.
Yeah, that went fast. 11 a.m., rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. Your hosts are Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, who's here helping the station manager and all the other things. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts or arts-related event or appear as an artist, Art on the Air at wvlp@gmail.com. Next week, we have Stop, Drop, and Rewind.
Yay.
That's your
they
group that you're bringing
so
in.
So much fun.
So we'll see you next week right here on 103.1 FM WVLP, Art on the Air, and Dua Sequenza will play us out.
Aloha.